Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. You know, last week I didn't have a must list and I was kind of sad about it, but I sure have one this week, along with a couple movie reviews and a television review and a good mix of things. So let's get started with the must list. How to Train Your Dragon, Netflix reality show The Devil's Plan, and Hallmark top this week's must list. A crime thriller novel from the Doctor Who showrunner and a Los Angeles film festival round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. I got to see some great Broadway theater heading into last week's Tony Awards. Purpose was so deserving of its Best Play win. Featured actor in a musical winner, Jake Malone, is magic in Operation Mincemeat, and Boop star Jasmine Amy Rogers is, well, a star. But I'm devoting this week to Real Women Have Curves. The songs, the story, the performances, the new musical based on the 2002 indie film is a pure delight. Worth the trip to New York, but let's also hope it tours. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. First on the list, How to Train Your Dragon. Attention, all wannabe Vikings. It's time to return to the Isle of Berk. How to Train Your Dragon soars into theaters this weekend, and we're thrilled, and frankly relieved, to report it's a faithful live-action adaptation of a beloved animated classic. With incredibly realized dragons, Toothless is as adorable as ever, epic and stunning flight sequences, and an expansive score from John Powell, who has simply never been better, it's the perfect summer nostalgia romp that's sure to attract a whole new generation of dragon riders, too. The Devil's Plan. Netflix's Korean reality competition series is back to break your brain with another season of insanely difficult equation-based games. There are also some new surprises along the way, involving secret rooms, submerged clues, and expanded prison stays. It's another devil of a good time. Hallmark's Passport to Love. Save money on airfare this summer and let Hallmark jet you across the world. This 9-movie collection features films set in Greece, Argentina, Ireland, and more. Fun in the summer sun? Yuck. 756 minutes of escapist schmaltz, please. Death at the White Hart. Former Doctor Who showrunner Chris Chibnall returns to his crime thriller roots with his debut novel, a macabre, suspenseful murder mystery. When a detective returns home to her small village, she's confronted with a gruesome crime scene and secrets of a place she thought she knew. And our last item, last remaining seats. This Los Angeles Conservancy annual program gives new meaning to summer movie season, with the chance to see classics in the movie palaces of Hollywood's golden age. Audiences can step back in time, taking in a Hitchcock double feature or classic Western High Noon in downtown Los Angeles' historic theater district. That's our must list for this week, How to Train Your Dragon, Netflix reality show The Devil's Plan, and Hallmark top this week's must list. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. So let's take a look at the review about How to Train Your Dragon. Live-action remake doesn't breathe new life into story, but still soars. Does it really need to exist? Probably not. This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. Hollywood loves a trend, and Universal gets in one of the most popular of the moment with a new live-action version of DreamWorks' How to Train Your Dragon. The film, in theaters June 13th, is by no means necessary, as holds true for the vast majority of these live-action updates. Its storytelling is a beat-for-beat match to its animated predecessor, with Jean Dubois, who co-wrote and co-directed the 2010 original, returning to both jobs. He's flying solo without colleague Chris Sanders, who, in a bit of release schedule kismet, is also the voice of Stitch in the Lilo and Stitch live-action film. In terms of avoiding any pedant or cloying changes in the storytelling, hiring Dubois to shepherd the film from one iteration to another was a wise choice. He avoids many of the pitfalls of the worst of these updates, and he expertly tweaks the tone to match the more hair-raising stakes of the live-action version. Everything here feels more dangerous, the brutal face-offs between man and beast, as well as the harshly beautiful landscape, hitting harder with their amplified realism. As in the 2010 film, we follow young Viking Hiccup, played by Mason Thames, an inventive, kind boy who is struggling with the fact that he doesn't measure up to the other dragon slayers in his village or the expectations of his father, Chief Stoic, reprised by original voice actor Gerard Butler. But when Hiccup shoots down a night fury, he can't bring himself to kill the dragon, leading to an unlikely friendship between himself and the creature he dubs Toothless. Toothless helps him learn ways to excel in dragon-fighting training, using brains and creativity rather than brawn to succeed. When Hiccup realizes that the dragons themselves are in thrall to a vicious dragon queen, he tries to convince his fellow Vikings to abandon their bloodlust, but they ignore him until a climactic battle reveals the truth of what he's told them. Animated or brought to life with human actors, it's a compelling story, one that sings the praises of compassion, intelligent solutions, and leading with diplomacy and understanding rather than bloodlust and brute force. Dubois wisely assembles a marvelously talented cast, most notably in the case of Mason Thames, who carries the film as Hiccup. With a mop of Disney Channel-worthy hair, Thames is endearing as a kid just trying to make his dad proud. His range, from adventurous spirit to love-struck teen to brave hero, plays across his face with ease. Thames believably crafts a bond with his CGI dragon, who is rendered in all his scaly glory. Indeed, it's a bit ironic that one of the best parts of the film is still essentially animated. Getting the opportunity to see the myriad of dragon breeds as realistic, life-size versions enhances their terrible beauty. Here, every scale ripples, every scorch mark burns, in contrast to the gentler approach of the cartoon. Toothless, with his expressive green eyes and oversized feet, reads as an adorable puppy bonding with his master. It's a challenge not to fall for him immediately. It's a fun exercise to see Gerard Butler bring to life a role he gave voice to 15 years ago, and he's certainly aged into the grizzled face and physique of a Viking chief, even if the mounds of armor, hair, and beard somewhat obscure his performance. Meanwhile, Nick Frost offers a softer, more restrained version of blacksmith and trainer Gobber, who Craig Ferguson originally voiced. Given that the danger feels more real across the board, it's an effective shift. Hiccup's passel of fellow trainees are a barrel of laughs with Harry Trevaldwin, who plays Toughnut, Bronwyn James, who plays Roughnut, Julian Dennison, who plays Fishlegs, and Gabriel Howell, who plays Snotlout, bring the majority of the film's comic relief, and delivering it without ever overplaying the jokes. Nico Parker shines as Astrid, the tough young woman consumed with proving herself the best of the Slayers. Her Astrid is less a hewn warrior, more an uncertain teen who vacillates between confidence and nervous energy. Dubois gets ample support from his production team. Cinematographer Bill Pope photographs the rough and rugged terrain of Viking territory with an eye for its sublime beauty and staggering scale. Costume designer Lindsay Pugh creates a panoply of Viking garb that balances its intricate historical detail with a healthy dollop of whimsy. The entire thing is tied together with John Powell's score, which replicates and expands on his music from the 2010 film. The Scottish and Scandinavian influence rings throughout his compositions, and he offers a stirring soundtrack to the film's adventures. How to Train Your Dragon will undoubtedly become a favorite for a new generation of families, though be warned, the realism of live action makes it far scarier than its animated sibling. Still, there's honestly no real reason for this iteration to exist. At least, though, it doesn't cheapen its source material, trusting in the good dragon bones that have always been there. In that regard, the film is every bit as earnest, captivating, and thrilling as its animated twin. And maybe that's enough. That was the review of How to Train Your Dragon. Live-action remake doesn't breathe new life into story, but still soars. It was by Maureen Lee Lanker, who's giving the movie a grade of B. There's a sidebar piece to this. How to Train Your Dragon breaks down that epic toothless flying scene. I was squealing inside. Writer-director Dean Dubois breaks down the pivotal sequence from tip to tail. This is by Lauren Huff. There are a few key points that they list first. Writer-director Dean Dubois breaks down how he nailed the epic flying scene, from Toothless's design to making Hiccup star Mason Thames look like he was really riding a dragon. Thames' mom suggested playing the film score while he shot the scene, which he says helped tremendously. Much of the movie was shot at the same Belfast studio where Game of Thrones was filmed. Dubois says when they first arrived, King's Landing was still standing in the back lot. Mid-movie spontaneous applause is a relatively rare honor in cinema today, but there's one moment so eye-poppingly good in the live-action remake of How to Train Your Dragon that it caused audiences to burst into cheers at every screening of the film that Entertainment Weekly has been to. That scene in question is pivotal to both the 2010 animated original and the new film, and features Hiccup, played by Mason Thames, and his beloved Night Fury dragon Toothless, learning to fly together. Set to John Powell's iconic score, the two take their first full, successful flight, soaring through the sea and skies and cementing their lasting friendship once and for all. Hey, we're not crying, you're crying. Ahead, writer-director Dean Dubois breaks down exactly how he brought the epic moment to life in all of its live-action glory. Assembling the team. Well, it started with a phone call from Universal talking about how they were thinking of kicking the tires on an idea of revisiting How to Train Your Dragon, reimagining it, and that first conversation was really about the dragons, Dubois recalls. How are we going to sell that with human actors on screen and built sets and shooting on location, he adds. How could we really blend them in and not lose the personalities and the traits that define them? The real first step, then, was to do a lot of concept design work with visual effects company Framestore, visual effects supervisor Christian Mance, and animated supervisor Glenn McIntosh, who comes from George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic and Jurassic Park fame. He was bringing that kind of paleontology and study of large animal movement to the wonderful, whimsical character creation that Framestore is really known for, DeBlois says of Macintosh. Hatching the dragons. From there, they had to bring the dragons to life, with special emphasis on Toothless, of course. Right from the start, we were looking at the animated movie and talking about the animal references that we had for each specific dragon, which kind of defined who they were in terms of temperament, but also in terms of design, DeBlois says. For example, Astrid's dragon, a deadly nader, is based on tropical birds, so it's curious, moves fast, and sports vivid colors. Whereas the Gronkle, Fishlegs' dragon, might be a bit more lazy and walrus or hippo-like, and equally temperamental, but a lot more lovable in his bulldog-like tendencies, DeBlois explains. Even in the animated films, Toothless is different than the other dragons, eschewing the more reptilian look the other beasts have. Several different species inspired the fan favorite, but DeBlois cites a black panther as the main inspiration for his overall aesthetic. This created a challenge when bringing him to life in live action, though. As we started experimenting and we were taking those giant eyes and shrinking them down to something that might be more believable in the real world, with every little increment, we lost more and more of Toothless, DeBlois says, admitting the process was a lot of trial and error in the beginning. So it was all of these adjustments. It's like, okay, well, I guess we need the big mouth, and we need the ear plates, and we need the big eyes, he says. So a lot of the work just went into getting the basics right, like the skeleton, the muscle, and the skin texture with his iridescent scales, and trying to give it a lot of credible features on top of something that we knew had to have an exaggerated expression and exaggerated facial design. Time to fly. Creative team? Check. Star Mason Thames as Hiccup? Check. Toothless? Check. The only thing left to do? Then we had to figure out how are we going to make these things fly and fly with humans on top of their backs, DeBlois says. That was a lengthy development period where we worked with some really amazing people who build gimbals and setups for humans to ride in other movies. Specifically, the filmmaker says the goal was for it to feel like Hiccup is a jockey on a horse, moving in sync with the animal's movements. That ultimately led to the construction of this giant contraption, which is about 8 or 10 feet tall, and it moves on pistons, and so it moves in 6 different axes according to what we need the dragon to be doing, he explains, but that isn't all. On top of that, there was an animatronic dragon body, neck, and head that we would put a saddle on, DeBlois says, adding when Mason would sit in the saddle and hold on, he's got these little handles that are affixed to Toothless's neck. The director continues, Mason would actually move along with whatever we did because we could control it remotely and on the spot. Whether the dragon was ascending or banking or rolling, all of those movements would affect Mason. So he was moving with the dragon. He wasn't just sitting in a saddle and being shifted around a little bit, as we've seen in some other productions. The idea was to make it really feel like they were symbiotic and they were partners in flying. Thank you for the music. Speaking of themes, while the 17-year-old star would visualize his dog, Pitbull Boxer Mix Brish, for the more emotional scenes with Toothless, he needed a little extra something for the flight sequence. It was his mom's idea to play the film score by returning composer John Powell on set for Thames to listen to while they filmed it. So during that scene, I'm listening to the music and it's absolutely insane, he says. that helped tremendously because in the grand scheme of it, I'm on a gimbal with a bunch of blue screens with hair dryers blowing in my face, trying to look cool on a dragon. Even still, while he admits that it was such a special moment filming that scene as a whole, he still didn't know exactly what to expect when he watched the final product for the first time. You never know what it's going to look like. I had no clue whatsoever. But after I saw the film and saw that scene, it blew my mind. For me, I was working with something that was not there, and to see a dragon and it looked so real, it was crazy. We're not in Westeros anymore. As for actually shooting the big flight sequence, or indeed any of the film's many dragon flights, Dubois says an indoor blue screen was used. However, he adds, we were very precise with the shots, having pre-visualization done of each shot, so we knew exactly what the camera was going to have to do and what the writer would be doing. Shots involving water were done in an underwater tank at London's famous Pinewood Studios. All of this, however, was in contrast to the bulk of the film, which was shot in and around Belfast, Ireland, specifically at Titanic Studios, on the same site as another famous series involving dragons, Game of Thrones. When we first arrived, King's Landing was still standing in the back lot, and we're like, get this out of here, Dubois says, laughing. Though the flight sequences called for blue screen sets and VFX magic, Dubois, who was the co-director or director on all three of the animated originals, is overjoyed to tell us how lovingly and painstakingly created the sets were for everything else, from the village of Burke to the dragon training arena to the interior and exterior of the chief's house, or the marina, and Burke's Great Hall. All in a day's work. Seeing everything, especially the magical Toothless and Hiccup flight, come together was such an exciting process and surpassed Dubois' wildest dreams, he says. It did not disappoint. I was squealing inside, he says, of getting the moment right. But to be fair, he says he was giddy all the time. Every morning we'd show up and be freezing and everyone's drinking their coffee and I would just walk around the sets like eyes wide, touching everything, he says. So much love was put into every detail of it, and I love that. And Dubois wasn't the only one. From the very first day on set, he says, there was just a sense of childlike wonder for everyone among the cast and crew, veteran or newbie. He puts it down to an unlikely mantra he gave on day one. I just said that I don't know how this movie will do in theaters. I don't know how audiences will respond to it, but I can promise you that at the end of the day, it's going to be something you're proud of and you can take your families to and feel like it was worth all the time spent in the late nights and on the weekends, he says. It is quite a sacrifice when you go into these film shoots. People work really hard, really long days, and it can weigh on you physically and in other aspects of your life, but when it's a good movie, it's all worth it. That was How to Train Your Dragon director breaks down that epic toothless flying scene. I was squealing inside, and it was by Lauren Huff. So let's get to another movie, Materialists. In this review, Dakota Johnson is caught between Chris Evans and Pedro Pascal in a sly yet charming romance. Celine Song does her best Jane Austen in this romantic comedy about contemporary dating and love. It's by Maureen Lee Linker. Should one marry for love or money? That's the thorny question at the heart of Materialists, the new sociological rom-com from writer-director Celine Song, who we know for past lives. The query may feel mercenary, but that's by design, as Song seeks to dissect the realities of the fact that marriage is and always has been a business deal, particularly when it is literally your business, as it is for heroine Lucy, played by Dakota Johnson. Song draws on her own experiences as a professional matchmaker to craft her protagonist, a young woman who sees success in dating as pure mathematics. Lucy is caught in her own push and pull between what she says she wants from a partner and the reality of meeting your partner. She vacillates between ex, John, played by Chris Evans, a perpetually broke aspiring actor, and finance guy, Harry, played by Pedro Pascal. I hesitate to call their interactions a love triangle since Lucy keeps the boundaries of each relationship fairly distinct, but there is the classic suspense of who she will choose. Once upon a time, Lucy and John were deeply in love, living in a tragic apartment in New York, pursuing their dreams of acting. But after a series of disappointing anniversary meals and growing tension over money, she dumped him because she hated him for being poor. It might sound callous, but anyone who has ever witnessed a relationship fall apart under the strain of financial stress can understand the truth of the experience. Lucy, as we meet her, is the best matchmaker at her firm and hard as nails. Less a gold digger, so much as a diamond miner with a pickaxe. Her job is to evaluate a person's tangible assets, their height, weight, build, income, age, and find them a match who checks all, or most, of their boxes. But over the course of the film, Lucy discovers both in her personal and professional life that a true, perfect match involves something far more intangible than the numbers she can record on a form. There's a version of this film where Lucy would be the villain, the side character keeping a doe-eyed heroine from a man who can't see the ideal woman right in front of him. A read where Lucy is the dreaded, unlikable woman. But Song is far too smart for that. Instead, she employs the trappings of romance to explore larger questions of marriage, love, and the complexities of gender politics. Materialists shares more in common with the wry social satire of a Jane Austen novel than a classic rom-com, excepting the strange, utterly unnecessary frame story of the first cave people to get married. Similar to Austen, Song understands that while a love match is, of course, ideal, the realities of life mean that oftentimes security and other considerations come into play. And you don't see any Austen heroines marrying poor men, do you? Song and her cinematographer, Shabir Kirchner, shoot New York City with the golden sheen of a romantic comedy. It's all sleek lines and golden, luscious interiors, the New York of Nora Ephron. It contrasts with the darker blues and grays that dominated the palette of Song's past lives, lending Lucy's world the idealized setting that she constructs for her clients, but scarcely believes in herself. Johnson, who can often be cool and detached in her work, is perfectly cast as Lucy, using that quality to underscore Lucy's brittleness and the way her past disappointments have jaded her. Lucy is blunt at every turn, often to the point of brutality, but her assessment of the ways in which financial security remains a key dating consideration for even the most independent of women is both keenly perceptive and a personal defense mechanism. In a world where marriages are, typically, no longer about uniting kingdoms, acquiring land, or trading livestock, what is their value and purpose? Materialists doesn't necessarily set out to answer that, but it wants us to ponder it all the same via Lucy's relationships with two men. On paper, Harry is perfect. A unicorn, as Lucy describes him. Pedro Pascal, with his easy charm and leisurely smile, is a natural fit for the guy any woman would consider themselves lucky to be with. As finance bros go, he's enlightened, self-deprecating, and self-aware enough to transcend the implications of that world. But Pascal, for all the twinkle in his eye, often plays relatively sexless characters, from the fatherly energy of The Last of Us to the ascetic qualities of The Mandalorian. Song wisely foregrounds that element of Pascal's star power, demonstrating how love, despite its low ranking in Lucy's qualities for a good match, is far more essential than she wants to admit. And it must be said, for a movie that explores how we might distill elements of attractions and chemistry, it's a fairly sexless endeavor on the whole. Chris Evans, who has squandered much of his post-Marvel career reveling in roles ridden with douchebaggery, contrasts Pascal as an irresistible screw-up, a golden retriever of a man who can't seem to reckon with the fact that sometimes love is not enough. He's wholesome and winsome, making it clear from his first entrance why Lucy once loved him. His chemistry with Johnson isn't raging, but warm and solid, the embers of a campfire that has been well tended. There's also a more dramatic thread running throughout the storytelling, acknowledging that for women, dating is not merely hard work, but also an inherently risky, if not outright dangerous, proposition. Because no matter how good a match someone appears to be on paper, the fear of sexual violence is never far from mind. Song weaves this into her meditation on marriage and love, and it's initially a poignant and effective undercurrent, but then it becomes a shoehorned impetus for Lucy's own self-realization and personal growth, undercutting the power of her emotional and intellectual dilemma. Because what she realizes is this: love is essential because it doesn't come from someone's height, weight, or the size of their pocketbook. It comes from truly knowing a person. "I'm not asking for a miracle," says Lucy's client Sophie, played by Zoe Winters. "I just want to love someone, someone who can't help but love me back." Materialists doesn't offer any easy answers despite delivering on its romantic premise. It acknowledges that happiness is sometimes a very bad financial decision, but that a happy life with a partner is also not something we can manufacture from numbers on an input form. Instead, it is something we must choose to be brave enough for, because love isn't a formula, but something altogether more infuriating, complicated, confusing, intangible, and magical. Something that might actually be a bit of a miracle. That was The Materialist's review. Dakota Johnson is caught between Chris Evans and Pedro Pascal in a sly yet charming romance. It was by Maureen Lee Lanker, who's giving the movie a grade of B+. Before I start our next review, I need to remind everybody that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. So what's that next review? It is on television. It's The Gilded Age. Season 3 is the drama's best yet. In Season 3, HBO's The Gilded Age broadens its focus to include Black high society, resulting in the most entertaining and satisfying outing yet. This is by Kristen Baldwin. The real Gilded Age in American history was a time of rampant political corruption, flagrant consolidation of wealth, and grotesque racism. Depressing, right? Let's talk instead about The Gilded Age, Julian Fellowes' opulent period drama featuring sumptuous costumes, swoony romance, and an all-star cast that clearly delights in bringing this lavish soap to life. In the upcoming third season, Fellows and his team continue to focus largely on the beauty of the titular era rather than its uglier realities. But the new episodes of HBO's Gilded Age finally deliver stories for its Black characters that are as robust as those for their white counterparts. And the result is the show's most satisfying and entertaining outing yet. Though the season 2 finale aired nearly a year and a half ago, The new episodes pick up just a few months later. Kind-hearted Marion Brooke, played by Louisa Jacobson, and her wealthy beau, Larry Russell, played by Harry Richardson, are courting in secret due to Miss Brooks's recent failed engagement to another man. Marion's aunt, Agnes Van Rien, played by Christine Baranski, is usually quick to disapprove of her niece's romances, but the stately socialite is too busy adjusting to her new penniless reality and the fact that her widowed sister, Ada Forte, played by Cynthia Nixon, now holds the purse strings. Over at the mansion across the street, Larry's younger sister, Gladys, played by Tysa Farminga, is sneaking around with her milquetoast suitor, Billy Carlton, played by Matt Walker, even though she knows her mother, the formidable Bertha Russell, played by Carrie Coon, wants to marry her off to the Duke of Buckingham, played by Ben Lamb. While Bertha's husband George, played by Morgan Spector, opposes pushing his daughter into a marriage she doesn't want, he remains more focused on his work acquiring the land and money needed to build a cross-country railroad line. As for the downstairs crew, the Van Rien's footman, Jack Trotter, played by Ben Ehlers, waits anxiously as Larry Russell begins seeking a buyer for his patented alarm clock design. Meanwhile, the Russell's butler, Mr. Church, played by Jack Gilpin, and his staff seek to ferret out a spy who's been leaking details about the family's private life to the press. For the first two seasons, the only Black character to have any interaction with the Fifth Avenue crowd was Peggy Scott, played by Denae Benton, a Brooklyn-based reporter and aspiring writer who also works as Agnes's personal secretary. Though Peggy and her family, including her mother Dorothy, played by Audra McDonald, and her pharmacist father, Arthur, played by John Douglas Thompson, had their own storylines, the show never really delved into the world of the well-to-do Black elite who existed at that time. With season three, Fellows and his co-writer Sonia Warfield correct this by extending its focus to the concentric social circles of Black and white New Yorkers, and at times even letting them shift and intersect. Theater lovers will be thrilled to learn that Gilded does, at long last, find a way to have McDonald's Dorothy and Barinski's Agnes share some scenes, under circumstances I won't spoil. More importantly, the new season takes us inside Black high society. Peggy meets a handsome young doctor named William Kirkland, played by Jordan Donica, and much of their courtship takes place in Newport, Rhode Island, where his affluent parents Elizabeth, played by Felicia Rashad, and Frederick, played by Brian Stokes Mitchell, live year-round. The Gilded Age is equal parts history and fantasy, so it'd be unfair to expect a fully realistic depiction of the racism Peggy and company would actually face. Still, this season, Fellows allows the characters to have their most pointed conversations about race so far. Agnes informs the Scots that she was brought up to treat everyone with simple good manners, prompting Arthur to respond, "I'm not convinced good manners will prove an effective cure for 2.5 centuries of slavery." Peggy and her family even encounter bias within their own community, specifically from Elizabeth, who disapproves of the Scott family due to their darker skin and Arthur's past as a slave. As always, Fellows and Warfield balance the social issues of the time with domestic drama. Adding to Agnes's umbrage about losing her fortune is Ada's decision to get involved in the burgeoning temperance movement, which she sees as a way to honor her late husband. A well-known Fifth Avenue wife is blindsided when her husband announces he wants a divorce, which will leave her exiled from New York society, as per the rules established by the city's social arbiter, Lena Astor, played by Donna Murphy. This gross imbalance of power between men and women is what drives Bertha to push Gladys into marriage with the Duke, because she understands the grim fact that a woman's value is inexorably tied to the man at her side. Still, her unwillingness to take her daughter's feelings into account, as well as a crisis in George's business dealings, begins to put a strain on the Russells' marriage. The performances remain stellar. Baranski reigns over every one of her scenes as Agnes, who wields her inflections as a master artist wields her brush. I'll spend the rest of my days with society's cast-offs and women of ill repute. Nixon brings a gentle strength to Ada, and Kuhn is haughty perfection as Bertha. Not only do we get the thrill of seeing Baranski and MacDonald on screen together, but the latter's Dorothy also has a gripping face-off with Rashad's Elizabeth. What a time to be alive! Once again, the guest cast is superb. Bill Camp, sporting a magnificent handlebar mustache, is gloriously gruff as Wall Street power broker J.P. Morgan, who joins George in his railroad scheme. Andrea Martin is suitably theatrical as Madame Dashkova, a so-called medium, and Lisa Gay Hamilton makes a welcome appearance as suffragist Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, who recruits Peggy to her cause. Merritt Weaver arrives as Bertha's sister, Monica, who is as grounded and unfussy as Mrs. Russell is grand. Apologies to the many, many other actors in this vast ensemble. You're all due individual accolades, but this review is already running long. The season's only misstep comes in the finale, when the growing tension between George and Bertha builds to a climax that is somewhat confounding and, in this viewer's opinion, out of character for George. The revelation feels particularly tacked on in an episode that's otherwise filled with glamour, two balls, a romantic proposal, and hard-fought social victories. But it's a small quibble, and after three increasingly enjoyable seasons, perhaps it's best to trust that fellows in Warfield know what they're doing. As Bertha says to her disapproving husband, "I won't question your business if you don't question mine." The Gilded Age, Season 3, premieres Sunday, June 22nd at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Times on HBO. That was the Gilded Age review. Season 3 is the drama's best yet. It was by Kristen Baldwin, who's giving Season 3 a grade of A-. For the top story, when I opened up Entertainment Weekly, or EW.com, it was Pixar gives first look at Toy Story 5's surprising new villain. The studio also announced Gatto, that's G-A-T-T-O, a film about a black cat in Venice. This is by Wesley Stenzel. Toy Story 5 is just a year away, and Pixar is giving a first look at concept art from its latest sequel. Pixar's chief creative officer, Pete Docter, appeared at the Annecy International Animation Film Festival in Annecy, France, on Friday to tease the new adventures of Buzz and Woody, as well as several other upcoming animated projects. Festival goers viewed the first footage from Toy Story 5, which saw Buzz Lightyear wake up on a beach surrounded by other Buzz toys. The army of Buzzes seemingly washed up from a shipping container that fell overboard, and they all gradually remember their allegiance to Star Command before crafting a makeshift raft to escape the island. Docter also confirmed that Joan Cusack is returning to voice Jessie, the iconic cowgirl doll first introduced in Toy Story 2. He showcased new concept art of the character alongside Bullseye and Buzz confronting a formidable new adversary, a frog-themed tablet named Lilypad, which competes with the toys for Bonnie's attention. It's a new tech tablet which allows Bonnie to chat with their friends and play games and other things too, Docter teased at a June 5th presentation in New York City. But Lily can also be a bit sneaky and prickly to be around, and because in her mind, it's a lot better to be socialized, and Bonnie needs to move on from toys. The film will also see Jessie fulfilling her duties overseeing Bonnie's room following Woody's departure at the end of Toy Story 4, until Tom Hanks's beloved cowboy returns to reunite with his pals. Woody is called back to help, Doctor said, on June 5th, but it's been a while since they've all seen each other, and he and Buzz don't always see eye to eye. Toy Story 5 is written and directed by Andrew Stanton, the Pixar veteran behind hits like Finding Nemo and WALL-E. Though this marks his first directorial effort in the franchise, Stanton was one of several credited screenwriters on all four preceding Toy Story movies. The film will release on June 19, 2026. Hanks and Tim Allen are returning to voice Woody and Buzz, respectively. Additionally, Conan O'Brien was recently cast as a new character named Smarty Pants, and Ernie Hudson was announced as the new voice actor playing Combat Carl, who was previously voiced by the late Carl Weathers in Toy Story 4. Elsewhere, during the studio's Annecy presentation, Pixar announced a new original film, Gatto, which is set to release in the summer of 2027. Set in Venice, the film follows a black cat named Nero, who befriends a street musician and struggles to disentangle herself from the feline mob. Gatto will be Pixar's second feature from director Enrico Casarosa, who previously wrote and directed 2021's Luca, which was also set in the filmmaker's native Italy. Doctor teased that the film will possess a new visual aesthetic distinct from Pixar's previous projects. Venice is like a living painting, Doctor said on June 5th. We're trying to bring the depth and dimension that you expect from a Pixar film while at the same time capturing that painterly texture. Aside from the sci-fi adventure Elio, which hits theaters next week, Pixar's next film will be Hoppers, from which the studio also showed footage during its Annecy presentation. The comedy film follows young nature lover Mabe as she attempts to prevent the construction of a new highway that threatens the woodlands, and jumps into the body of a robotic beaver in the process. Mabel hops into this adorable beaver, Doctor said on June 5th. It's kind of like Avatar, but cuter when she first hops. It is an incredible experience. To now inhabit an animal body is absolutely surreal. She loves it, and going out into nature is a dream come true. Hoppers stars Piper Curda as Mabel, John Hamm as the villainous Mayor Jerry, and Bobby Moynihan as King George of the Beavers. Written and directed by We Bear Bears creator Daniel Chong, the film is set to release on March 6, 2026. There was some additional reporting here by Nick Romano, but the article is credited to Wesley Stenzel. That was Pixar Give's first look at Toy Story 5's surprising new villain. Where can you watch The Chosen? It's more confusing than you might think. The wildly popular drama about Jesus of Nazareth has bounced between multiple streamers. This is by Randall Colburn. Hallelujah! A new season of The Chosen is upon us. A multi-season exploration of the life and death of Jesus of Nazareth, the series began in 2019 as a crowdfunded project of the VidAngel platform. Since then, it's grown considerably in scale, with creator Dallas Jenkins, the son of Left Behind series co-author Jerry Jenkins, revealing a 7-season plan that's approaching fruition. Season 5 premieres in June 2025, and Season 6 is currently in production. As The Chosen grew in popularity, Jenkins worked to make it more widely available. At various points in its run, episodes aired on the CW and streamed on platforms such as Netflix, Peacock, and YouTube, not to mention the show's official app and website. beginning with its third season, select episodes were also screened in movie theaters around the globe. In 2025, Jenkins announced that The Chosen would stream on Amazon Prime Video. Furthermore, Amazon MGM Studios committed to premiering episodes of its 5th, 6th, and 7th seasons in theaters before they land on the streamer, per deadline. It's a lucrative endeavor, as the screenings of The Chosen have proven to be successful at the box office. Confused? That's okay. If you're wondering where to watch The Chosen, we've got the answers. What is The Chosen about? Perhaps you've heard this one before, but The Chosen tells the story of Jesus of Nazareth as he builds a ministry, performs miracles, and marches towards his fate as recounted in the Bible. It's a familiar story, sure, but this isn't the Passion of the Christ. Stories about the Son of God are often passion plays about his trial, suffering, crucifixion, and resurrection, but The Chosen distinguishes itself by focusing on the life of Jesus, as seen through the eyes of those around him. While Jesus' death hangs heavy over the series, the first four seasons primarily center around him recruiting disciples, preaching his message, and performing miracles, with the latter drawing ire from various political and religious forces. Season 5, however, will set the stage for Jesus' eventual crucifixion and resurrection. In fact, the season is titled The Chosen Last Supper. The people of Israel welcome Jesus as king while his disciples anticipate his crowning, reads a synopsis. But instead of confronting Rome, he turns the tables on the Jewish religious festival. Their power threatened, the country's religious and political leaders will go to any length to ensure this Passover meal is Jesus' last. Where can I watch The Chosen? The Chosen Season 5 will stream on Amazon Prime Video on Sunday, June 15th, with the season's first two episodes available for subscribers. The next three episodes of The Chosen Season 5 will hit the streamer on Sunday, June 22nd, with the final three episodes arriving the following week on Sunday, June 29th. The Chosen Seasons 1, 2, 3, and 4 are currently available to stream on Amazon Prime Video. Not an Amazon subscriber? You have other options, including the ability to stream the show for free via the official The Chosen website, and that is linked in this article on EW.com. The Chosen is also streaming for free via the series' official app, which you can download via the App Store or Google Play. The app is compatible with iOS, Android, and Roku devices, as well as Apple TV, Amazon Fire TV, and Google TV. While you can currently watch the first four seasons of The Chosen on the app and website, Season 5 won't be available on those platforms until September 13, 2025. This is due to Prime Video having a 90-day exclusivity window for the season. Finally, Jenkins is hosting early live streams of select episodes via The Chosen's YouTube channel. The first episode of Season 5 was live streamed on June 8th, a week before its debut, and a live stream of Episode 3 is currently slated for Wednesday, June 18th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Stay tuned to the show's YouTube hub for updates about future live streams. The Chosen Last Supper will be available to watch for free on the Chosen app on September 13th, which is 90 days after its debut on Prime. So how did The Chosen Season 4 end? Set during the last year of Jesus' ministry, Season 4 of The Chosen found Jesus performing some of the Bible's most striking miracles, from giving sight to a blind man to raising Lazarus from the dead. It's the raising of Lazarus that really sets the stage for Season 5, as it's the miracle that turns the Pharisees against Jesus, leading them to side with the Roman authorities that want him killed. Season 4 ends before the Holy Week, with Jesus riding a donkey into Jerusalem, where he will later be crucified in Season 6. Season 5 unpacks the events of the Holy Week leading up to his death. who's in The Chosen Season 5 cast. Leading the cast of The Chosen is Jonathan Roumie, who appeared on episodes of Castle, NCIS Los Angeles, The Good Wife, and The Mindy Project before joining The Chosen as its Jesus of Nazareth. Season 5 will see the return of several key figures, including Luke Demian's Judas Iscariot, Joey Vahidi's Thomas, Elizabeth Tebbish's Mary Magdalene, and Vanessa Benavente's Mary of Nazareth, among others. Also returning is one of The Chosen's most recognizable faces, journeyman actor Paul Ben-Victor. In Season 5, Ben-Victor, a veteran of The Wire and Nobody Wants This, will reprise his role of King Herod. Is there a The Chosen Season 5 trailer? There is, and it currently has over 3.5 million views on YouTube. That is also linked in this article. Set to Johnny Cash's God's Gonna Cut You Down, the trailer teases Jesus' arrest, Judas's betrayal, and the oft-cited instance where Jesus cleansed the temple in Jerusalem by kicking out the merchants and overturning the tables of the money changers. The trailer also offers a glimpse of Jesus' final meal with his apostles, famously depicted in Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. That was Where Can You Watch The Chosen? It's More Confusing Than You Might Think, and it was by Randall Colburn. And that's it. We have finished another hour of Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Please come back next week to hear what I've found. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.